Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Vermont Commission on Women's video podcast for Asian American Pacific Islander Women's Equal Pay Day. We are acknowledging Asian American Pacific Islander Women's Equal Pay Day this year on March 9th. And this is the day in the year when Asian American Pacific Islander women need to work to catch up with what white men made in the previous year. So we have some guests today who are going to discuss this with us. We're gonna talk a little bit about their perspectives and their experiences and shed a little bit of light on what some of the impacts are of unequal pay for women in Vermont as well as nationally. Our guests today are, first, we have Senator Keisha Rahm. She's in her first term as a Vermont State Senator after previously serving in the Vermont House of Representatives on behalf of Burlington, Chittenden District 6-4 from 2008 to 2016. Her career in Vermont has spanned preschool education, legal advocacy for victims of domestic violence, and municipal civic engagement. She currently works to build social equity and inclusion in nonprofit organizations, businesses, school districts, and municipalities. Keisha was raised in her Indian immigrant father and Jewish American mother's Irish pub in Los Angeles. She's the great-great-granddaughter of famed Indian architect and philanthropist Sir Ganga Ram. She lives in Shelburne with her fiance, Jacob Hinsdale of Charlotte. And our second guest is Bor Yang. Bor serves as the executive director and legal counsel for the Vermont Human Rights Commission. As executive director, Bor supervises the investigations, litigates discrimination claims on behalf of the public interest, advances policies related to civil rights, and provides training on implicit bias, fair housing, bullying, harassment, and hazing, and more throughout the state of Vermont. She joined the commission in 2015 as a staff attorney and investigated claims of discrimination in housing, state government employment, and places of public accommodations. She completed her BA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and her Juris Doctor from the University of Minnesota Law School. Before moving to Vermont, Bor was a college instructor in a legal studies program and practiced law in the areas of family, government, and social security benefits, representing indigent clients and victims of domestic violence. Bor is Hmong. She and her family arrived in the US as refugees in 1980. And lastly, we have our host, who will be facilitating our conversation. And this is Lisa Senegal. Lisa is an entrepreneur, a business consultant focusing on creating equity and eliminating discrimination, a feminist activist, and last but not least, she is chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. Lisa, I turn this conversation over to you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Carrie, and good morning to both of you, Keisha and Bor. Really pleased that you were willing and able to take time to talk with us this morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. So we'll dive right in, and I'd like the conversation to be loose. If I've directed a question at one of you, but the other of you would like to chime in and answer, please feel free to do so. I want to make sure that both of your voices are in there on as much of this as you want to be. So thank you again. So how has, and I'll start with you, Bor, how has pay inequity and specifically the AAPI community, how has pay inequity affected you, but also how do you see it affecting the larger community?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's really about the, not just the difference in terms of making money, but having money, income versus wealth. And we know that wealth is accumulated over a lifetime or through generational inheritances. And so when we look at the long-term effect of wage disparities, we're really talking about a lifetime loss of anywhere between $240,000 up to $1 million in places like Alaska and Louisiana and Washington, D.C. And here in Vermont, Asian American women make only 64 cents on the dollar compared to their white male counterparts. That's a lifetime loss of $737,000. That's a home or two or three. That's college tuition for our children. That's missed opportunities for investments. It's a comfortable retirement at your average retirement age. And so when we think about pay inequities, it really sets us back, but it also sets our children back and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren as well.
Thank you. Keisha, can you speak to that as well?
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. And Boer really gave, I think, a lot of the quantitative overview. So I'll speak a little bit more historically and personally. So, and I'll try to only speak for the South Asian community, no big deal, you know, huge, huge part of the world. But, you know, again, we'll also just try to speak from my own experience. So my family originally fled the part of India that became Pakistan. So their refugee experience was within what is now the South Asian region. And I think one thing that's important to talk about, you know, it's hard because we're talking about our experience vis-a-vis white males. And at the same time, AAPI women, APIDA women, we've added the DACI for the D, do a lot better other women, including white women. And so, you know, we have to be looking at the reality that we did, most of us did not, and especially in the South Asian community, we did not come here as slaves. We did not come here under the same amount of duress. We actually came here because Asian American students were allowed to get student visas for the first time, starting in the mostly generally the 60s. So my father came to the United States because Asian American students were allowed to get visas. So we were, they really only wanted to import, and this continues with H-1B visas and other programs. They want to extract the brightest and most educated Asians from other parts of the world to bring to the United States. And those are seen as the ideal immigrants to have here. And then for those of us who generationally come after, it's a tremendous burden to carry that we were here because we are supposed to be educated and make money. My father, for example, got to UCLA and dropped out of the engineering program to open an Indian restaurant. Now that alone was, you know, an act of sabotage for our Indian family back home in India who were paying for him to be here. But he had the privilege of that access to capital to start with. And yet it was my white mother whose access to the Women's Bank of Los Angeles got them the loan for the restaurant. I will just say, you know, when I was 22 and became a state legislator, I told my Indian grandmother, you know, hey, I was elected to the legislature, and she would have rather I be like a starving artist. She said, oh, you used to love to sing. Could you please go back to that? I mean, being in politics or other things, even if they make money, aren't seen as respectable for a lot of our families back home. So, you know, there's other types of struggles we go through while acknowledging at the same time that we did not experience the legacy of genocide, slavery, or, you know, in more overt ways, at least in India, Americans coming and sabotaging our well-being so that we had to flee to find opportunity.
You mentioned that you were only going to speak for the South Asian community, and that brings up that there is, we lump all Asian American and Pacific Islanders into one enormous category, and there is tremendous diversity and disparity within that. Can either of you speak to that a little bit? Because you know, some folks are within groups who did not have the same experience as your immigrant grandparents or grandfather did. Keisha.
Yeah, Boer, do you want to take that first? I mean, I believe we're a big chunk of the global majority, you know, where there's a billion people in India alone. But Boer, I'll let you sort of share more of the diversity of the Asian American community, APIDA community.
I think that's a really great point, Lisa, that you made. The Asian American or APIDA group is very diverse. We have certainly members of that group that are fifth, sixth generation, and there's a benefit to that of having lived in America or been in America for generations. And then there are groups like my family who immigrated here in 1980, and I am still the first to do this, or the first to go to college, the first to go to law school, the first to graduate. And so there's the layer of immigration and immigration status and being considered foreign born on top of just being Asian American as well. And just a different history entirely as well. And Senator Ron talked about how her family came here and sort of the backdrop of that. The backdrop of how my family came here was a war-torn country, and American soldiers sort of being involved in that war, growing up in poverty and going to public school and being a kid receiving free school lunch. And so and living in a large metropolitan area and now a very rural state. And so we have very diverse experiences, and layered in all of that are all the other pieces too, being a woman, but also living in poverty, perhaps, mixed race versus not mixed race, immigration status, and all of those things sort of play into our experiences. And I think it's wonderful to acknowledge that we are not monolithic, but at the same time, there is also some commonalities in our experiences as well, because to others, we might look alike. And in that sense, we are grouped together. We have similar skin tone. And in that sense, and people may not be able to look at either Senator Rahm or myself and even notice that there's a difference between us. And so in that sense, we are also treated similarly in the world. And so, I think it's just wonderful to acknowledge our similarities, but also our differences as well. Mm.
One thing I want to say too is the Hmong community and a lot of Indian communities have in common that they were soldiers for other armies and never got credit for their contributions. You know, Indians were the second highest number of casualties on the Allied forces side fighting under British rule and in World War II, and barely got credit for their contribution. So we often say nowadays, oh, we have immigrants fighting our wars to get citizenship. What a horrible situation. That's always been the case. And many of us, you know, our ancestors were never given that that credit. You know, even within the South Asian community, my family experienced one of the largest mass migrations of people across a new border when the British redrew the borders in that part of Asia. And my family was Hindu, living in a country that became a Muslim country of Pakistan. And all of a sudden, they had to leave with just the clothes on their backs to get to India. And, you know, I mentioned my great-great-grandfather, Carrie mentioned it in my biography, Sir Ganga Ram, because he's somebody who sort of, the fable goes, he read in the lamplight, he was in the merchant class, but that didn't mean very much when you were sort of in one of the growing metropolitan areas between Turkey and India at the turn of, you know, the last century. So he read in the lamplight and became an engineer and architect and started building hospitals and schools for girls and colleges for women and homes for widows and irrigation systems. And, you know, I think often one of the saddest things for the Apida community is how much we've contributed to what we think of as modern society, and, you know, and it's so deep within our history, and yet not often recognized or celebrated here in the United States in our textbooks. You know, everything is sort of a relic of the very distant past, ignoring that we've, you know, contributed a lot to ideas of what modern society should look like.
Yeah, I was going to mention, I have no recollection, very little recollection of elementary through high school having any part of US history include the history of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders who either fought in wars for us or immigrated to this country and the contributions that they made. Certainly also true of African Americans, most other minorities. We've just skip those incredibly critical parts, which is part of the reason we have the situations that we have today, not the least of which is the pay disparity. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how do you see that pay disparity fitting into the larger civil rights movement and the ability to have a voice within that, because so many folks are just, when you are struggling to make ends meet, you have less opportunity to have a voice and participate in your own government and your ability to better your situation. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'll start with you, Bor.
Was that a gesture to unmute, or did you want to start?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm gesturing to you. Go ahead. Oh.
Well, you know, I also don't want to, I mean, I think because this is a history lesson too, you know, for a lot of people who don't know how deeply APIDA contributions have helped create this country. So, you know, there's also the differential experience of Asian men and Asian women, and there's different ways that both have been oppressed as well. I mean, when Chinese Americans came to the United States and built a lot of our infrastructure, including our railroad system, you know, often they were not allowed to bring any family members, any women, because, you know, they didn't want them to procreate and be actual citizens of this country. So there's a lot of exploitation of labor from Asian American communities that continues in many ways today. We want some Asians on our college campus, but not too many. So we're gonna put a quota on you, but you know, not on white people who are, you know, prolific on these college campuses. So, you know, there's still a lot of, we want to sprinkle in some Asian American folks, APIDA folks, but we can't be overwhelmed by them. And so you see that where you look at the University of California system, and Mandarin Chinese and Hindi are two of the most commonly spoken languages on their campuses. There's constant pushback. There's a constant feeling that somehow APIDA folks are taking over simply by being successful. You know, I see our responsibility in many ways. I mean, I think I have a lot of privilege to be part of the, you know, APIDA community, have access to that capital, those embedded networks. But at the same time, when my father got here from India, you know, he was told go back to Mexico. So I've seen a lot of what the experience looks like for other brown immigrants. A lot of Indian Americans really get it, that, you know, there is a difference between us and white folks. When my father first got here, he was constantly being arrested and told to go back to India. And at the same time, there was no box to check that he was Indian American. He was supposed to say that he was white. And yet we know the experience is so different. So with the resources and access to capital we do have, we need to help uplift our sisters and other folks who are suffering from this pay gap. You know, I think what constantly stymies us as APIDA women is we're always seen as the workhorse, not the show horse, you know, not the person you put in the leadership role, but the person you put just below to kind of do all the work and make someone else look good. And the more we let those stereotypes kind of fester, the worse it is for our communities. But I wouldn't say, you know, now we, along with Black women, have, you know, share the first woman to be the vice president, the first woman to break that glass ceiling into the White House. So I'm not saying that means we've arrived and we're fine, but all of these moments are opportunities for us to look back and say, but who got left behind and how do we bring them with us? But I have to say, it meant the world to me to hear Kamala Harris, you know, invoke her mother's name and invoke the name of so many immigrant stories, you know, in her ascent to the White House. And as Bor said, so much of it has to do with our immigrant experience and always feeling othered. Where are you from? When did you get here? You know, which some folks who are European American don't receive.
Bor, did you want to add?
Oh,
Go right ahead. I wanted to know if you had something you wanted to add to that.
I wanted to thank Senator Rahm for sort of just highlighting the important historical contributions that have been made by Asian Americans. And I really appreciated you doing that. And I just want to add also to that, that there have been studies that have shown us that even when women are considered qualified or competent or high achieving, that they're still deemed less desirable for hiring by employers. And so when we think about some of the stereotypes about Asian Americans, and some people would consider those stereotypes positive, they're also problematic, because just because someone, an employer, considers an Asian American or has a stereotype that an Asian American is a hard worker or diligent, doesn't necessarily equate to them liking us or actually wanting to hire us. And it certainly hurts us too, because there are stereotypes that Asian Americans don't fit into leadership positions. So yes, we are maybe are hireable, but not really at the highest positions or at the highest wage. We're not seen as supervisors or managers and so forth. And I just wanted to share that, like, personally, pay equity is an integral part of, like, the racial equity movement, because we know that when we are able to make money, it determines where we live, and where we live determines healthcare and transportation and where our children go to school. So not only are we interconnected as people, but these different facets of our lives are all also interconnected as well. And so you can't have a racial equity movement without bringing Asian Americans along and also considering wage equity for all.
So we've talked a lot about where things are right now, but I know both of you are very solutions oriented, very forward looking. So, tell us a little bit about what helps, what makes real progress, lasting change, what can we be doing in Vermont, and what does, you know, the country as a larger society need to be doing to advance not just pay equity, but equity in general in the country?
Well, first, you know, I keep being like the historian here, but, you know, it's really hard to try and do justice to all these different communities. And even remembering and acknowledging our history is really important. Representative Catherine Sims, you know, recently on the House floor gave a devotional where she reminded people of an anniversary of Japanese internment in the United States, and the reality that when Japanese people had accumulated some wealth and prosperity in California and the West, they were still seen as a threat and had all of their wealth and property stripped from them, and were interned in one of the, you know, most awful things we've done to a community in the country. So we have to remember, those are actions as well, to honor these stories and acknowledge that we have set communities back with our actions and with our prejudice. And so then to be able to look around now and say, how do I play a different tape in my head now? And as Bohr said, these stereotypes end up hurting us as well. They put us in boxes. Right. You know, we internally joke a lot about how our parents really want us to be nothing but, you know, doctors, engineers, maybe a lawyer, but that's not seen as ideal as a doctor or an engineer. But, you know, just the ability for Asian Americans, APIDA Americans, to be seen as, you know, an author or a comedian or, you know, a politician. These are all really new frontiers for us, and they matter. For more recent arrivals, we need to stop putting them through the same kind of the hazing that many immigrant communities have come through, where we just, you know, kind of say, well, that's just the American dream. You scrape and you figure it out until you have, you know, two pennies to rub together. But we need to help people with access to capital, home ownership, the ability to become entrepreneurs, language access, and making sure that if someone in Vermont, for example, speaks Nepali, they're not left for months in a pandemic without emergency information in their own language. They don't call the unemployment office or the, you know, business hotline and wait hours to get an interpreter on the phone. So there's a lot we can do related to the immigrant experience that we have very recent memory around, you know, what it looks like when a child interprets for their family in the presence of police, things that just shouldn't happen, that we took for granted maybe as younger people. Now we should have laws and, you know, better practices around. So that's a lot of what I'm fighting for.
Or?
I'll just answer the question about the wage disparities, but I echo everything that Senator Rahm has said thus far. And I don't think that we have the liberty to ignore the 30 plus years of studies on implicit bias. We know that unconsciously we're sabotaging our good intentions and efforts. We used to tell each other or ourselves, you can trust your gut, but maybe we need to start questioning whether our gut is trustworthy. Yeah. Studies have shown us that employers are changing what they consider as merit in real time to justify hiring men, and they're making hiring decisions because of that. And we have to do more than just reading and learning too. We have to actually implement policies and practices that remove discretion or mitigate discretion and provides for some type of means of comparison. And equity has to be more important to us than the bottom line or the minimum that the law requires, which I'm afraid is sort of how employers operate by default. What is the bottom line? What's the smallest amount of money I can pay for people? Even if that means I'm paying some a little bit more because they negotiated, or some a little bit higher because, or some a little less because they didn't. Or the law gives me the ability to raise any business necessity as why I'm paying people differently. And as an employer, to take ownership of the fact that that's just not good enough. The minimum that the law requires is not good enough. And always thinking about your bottom line is not going to advance equity. So when there's like wage disparities in the office, we have to look beyond those business reasons and why someone, or whether someone negotiated or didn't negotiate, or what someone made in a previous employment. Which, by the way, advantages men over women anyways. And really think about the quality and quantity of the work of a specific job, and is it the same from person to person? And what is that job valued economically? And so I just want to learn. The teacher in me says we have to learn. And the lawyer in me says, then we have to implement the policies and the practices to actually move forward.
Great. And then there's accountability. We have to make sure that people actually follow through when those standards are put in place. We have to have ways that we're holding people accountable and we are measuring progress so that we know, you know, the steps we're taking are actually having the intended consequences. And they're just not new things that sound good. But aren't creating the real change that we need. We're going to wrap up in just a second. Do either of you have any kind of final thoughts that you want to leave us with?
Well, I just want to thank the commission for starting on that journey. You have been on it for a little while, but particularly this year with storytelling of teasing apart what we mean by equal pay for women. I have spent many years in the legislature hearing from particularly Black women who have said, I work in a industry with a lot of women and I still feel like I'm being discriminated against by white women. So, you know, I have constantly been wanting us to get to a place culturally where we can acknowledge that there is an oppressive element of whiteness to our equal pay conversation, and that white women really need to stand up and not benefit at the expense of other, BIPOC folks, particularly BIPOC women. And so, you know, I just applaud the commission for being on that journey. I think what we all want is the same. You know, my grandmother never got a driver's license, never had a bank account, was never allowed to hold her own money. You know, when they were supposed to send money to my father in the United States, my grandfather, who had lost everything, would gamble and drink it away. And, you know, then I became like the first person in my father's line of folks who had a bank account. I cashed his checks. You know, I was the one who had to get financial literacy at a young age to help my immigrant parent, you know, who just really would rather put money under a couch because he had lived through a really horrific experience. Okay. So, you know, so much is possible. I was a free lunch kid too, you know, at one point, and just the programs that we have are wonderful if people know how to take advantage of them and know that if you're a free lunch kid, you can also take the SATs for free and you can do a lot of college applications for free. So the ways that we help people should just be more accessible. And then as Boris said, on the other side of it, we need our white aspiring allies to stand up for us and say, this doesn't feel fair. This person's not advancing. This person is not making as much as I am. And to really help uplift other women as we rise.
Thank you, Keisha. Four?
I echo all of that and just so grateful to be here today and to be sharing sort of this virtual stage with Senator Rahm. And just to add to that by saying that this is really about shared liberation. There is no singular civil rights movement without everybody being liberated. And so I feel especially grateful this morning then to the Commission on Women for highlighting how pay disparities affect all of us and each of us differently and similarly.
Well, thank you both so much for being here this morning, for the contributions you made to this conversation, but also the larger contributions that you are both making every day. And one of the really important, this conversation's part of it, is the education that you're sharing. And that includes with all the commissioners on the Commission on Women. We're very aware that we're at an early phase of fully understanding where we are with racial equity and what our role needs to be. So having conversations like this with both of you is so important, and your voices are important and appreciated. So thank you. I know you're both very busy. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank